I call this meeting of House Finance to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:34 p.m. on Monday, February 20. Present today is Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, Representative Tronc, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, and myself, Co-Chair Johnson. We are being assisted today by our LIO moderator, Emma Turner, and our finance secretary, Bree Wiley. Today, we are receiving a presentation on wildland fire suppression costs. It's presented by Helge Eng, Division of Forestry and Fire Protection and Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Eng, would you like to come forward, put yourself on the record, and if you would, introduce yourself and any additional presenters.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Helge Eng. I'm the Director of the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection and the Alaska State Forester. And with me today is Norm MacDonald, Deputy Director for Fire Protection, who will be giving the presentation today.
Well, welcome to House Finance. And seeing no starting comments or questions, you may begin your presentation.
All right, good afternoon. Appreciate you having us. I think before I start, I was kind of thinking how we could present this today and make sure you have all the information you need to make decisions now and moving forward. And a couple of things I want to talk about and go through before we go into the actual 2022 season and fire costs is just cover a little bit of the history of Alaska, how we got to where we are and the responsibilities that the state has as far as fire protection. Go into a little bit of some of the challenges we have with the changing conditions. And then over the last two decades, we've seen a significant change in fire activity, fire size, and the length of our fire seasons. And talk a little bit about how Alaska worked with all our other cooperators, the federal cooperators, number one. There's been confusion in the past on who's responsible for what and how that gets fires are paid for and reimbursed. So I'll spend a little time on that and then make sure I focus on what you asked me here today for, which was the 22 fire season. The first slide just is some of the highlights of the dates and times of some significant changes for the state. Pre-mid-70s, all the fire protection in Alaska was provided by the BLM. In the mid-70s to mid-1980s, that transitioned to the state Division of Forestry. That was done all through a contract. And as the state started to gain some of their divisions and build a program, that responsibility transitioned. And the last was completed in 1985, where we picked up the Southwest area. That's the McGrath office. And that remained fairly much the same through the 80s and 90s. In 2019, we made a statute change to reflect our mission. Previous to that, it was to protect the natural resource values at risk. And what we were doing and have been doing is protecting natural resource values along with the community's homes, infrastructure, businesses of Alaskans. So that change was made to reflect the mission. In 2021, we began a reorganization of our division. Historically, it was under one area or one state forester and under the forestry program. We've split that, so now we have a fire program and a forestry program, which allows us to put our emphasis and expertise in each of those missions. Slide three is just a introduction to the Alaska Interagency Fire Management Plan. This is the guiding document we use.
Before you get started, I have a quick question. This is Representative Johnson for the record. Just on the end of page two there, the Division of Forestry Reorganization, so did you divide into two branches and then come back together? This seems a little like you did something and then went back to a different way you were doing it before, or we just kind of talk about what you did there?
No, Madam Chair, we have, under one division, we have two branches, a fire protection branch and a forestry branch. And that is, so we have a deputy director of fire protection and a deputy director of forestry. And that allows us to focus both on those, the forestry mission and the fire protection mission under two separate branches.
Following up on that, so in 2021, was it just you were divided into two branches and then in 2022 was just a renaming. It really didn't, you didn't change the management structure.
2021, we began the reorganization. It's about a 3-year process. It involves some changing of the positions so we're anticipating that we have that completed by 2023. So we are, I would say, about 80% of our transition to our new organization.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And we have another question by Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the Chair. Just for my own edification and understanding, you're looking at the timeline starting in 1960, BLM established a contract with the state to provide fire protection. I assume that before that, the federal government paid for fire suppression, and when they established the contract, did the contract include funding to support fire suppression in the state of Alaska, or did we just take on that responsibility of funding it when we took on the responsibility to manage it? Let's put it that way.
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, that's my understanding is that was the transition after statehood. Where the federal government had fire protection responsibility. After statehood, the state assumed those responsibilities, and it took several years, I think, to make that transition. So the way I understand it is in 1960, the state paid a contract to the BLM, the federal government, for protection on all state lands, and through the 70s, that switched to where it became under the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry.
Follow up.
So for final clarification, then the federal government has no role in supporting us financially with our duties to suppress fires. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, there's a couple slides in here that will try to explain that, because I do understand that's been a question we've gotten before. If the next slide or two does not clarify that, I'll be happy to try to answer it for you.
All right. Thank you. All right.
So this slide indicates how we are involved with the Alaska Interagency Fire Management Plan. That's all agencies in Alaska, both federal, state, and the Native Land Management organizations. With the critical being the highest level of protection, that is primarily our roadside communities, our villages where we have our homes and life safety. Full is our second highest level of response. That's primarily natural resource values or remote cabin sites, remote lodges where there's still values, but it's not the immediate threat to life safety. And then limited being the lowest, which is the landscape model where we have I don't want to say let burn, but where fire plays its natural role in the landscape. There are no values at risk, and we let those fires play its natural role. All agencies in Alaska, whether it's any jurisdictional agency, follows this plan for fire suppression. And I think to answer your question, Representative Ortiz, this next slide shows how that breakout happens. The north side of the state, which is highlighted in yellow, is under BLM or Alaska Fire Service protection. The blue, which is the southern half of the state, is state of Alaska protection. And the green in the far south and southeast is the U.S. Forest Service, which is primarily the national forest. They protect their own lands. The graphic on the right is an illustration of the different jurisdictions or the land owners, the blue being the state, yellow being BLM, red is native lands. Whether that land falls within BLM jurisdiction or for protection or state jurisdiction, one of those two agencies will provide that protection. The jurisdictional agency is the agency responsible for the fire suppression costs. So if it's state of Alaska, I'm sorry.
We have a question. So when you're finished with that.
If the state of Alaska is providing protection on federal lands in our zone of protection, we are reimbursed by the federal government for those actions. And likewise, if the BLM provides protection on state lands in their protection zone, we pay the suppression cost for that action.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. McDonald, I'm going back to slide 3 where you've introduced to us the critical, full, modified, and limited. And I guess I'm curious on that. In the northernmost area, it's using Barrow, but we refer to it as Ukviagvit. It has its critical, and then there's another little swath coming to the east of that that's also critical. But it first I thought, oh, it's because it's where North Slope, but it isn't really seem to be marked as Prudhoe on there. And so I'm trying to figure out, is there a fire history there that we gets the designation of critical? Just trying to figure out why some areas are designated as critical, even though it seems like when we're protecting human life would be other areas. And again, it didn't seem like we're saying anything around our industrial hub, but Prudhoe Bay is critical, but the population center in Ukviagvik is in critical management status.
Representative Hannon, or sorry, through the chair, Representative Hannon, I will have to double check that. The areas that are critical or the any of the management options are selected by the land manager, the manager of those lands. We have, for the state, we have state, private, and municipal. So we work with those communities to define what protection level they will get, they will receive. I can't speak to the North Slope, why there is critical up there. I'm assuming it's population-based, but I can double-check that and get back to you. That's in Alaska Fire Service Protection. Historically, we have not had a big fire workload up there, although that has changed over the last several years. We're seeing more. But I can try to do some research and get back to you on that one.
And one quick follow-up on that same thing, Chair Johnson.
Representative Hannon.
Which is, in figuring that out, and I understand local controls of saying that in population center of the North Slope, but it would seem from where I sit that we want to make sure that the Prudhoe Bay area, where we don't have a lot of wildfires, but if they, in the next 10 years, become a thing, that we as a state want to make sure that we are stopping a wildfire from spreading into a infrastructure area that we is pretty critical. So wondering whether the state can weigh in on that versus just the local land managers saying population center, because it would seem to me that a wildland fire spreading into a petroleum producing area would be a really bad thing.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon, yeah, and I agree, and I should clarify, the jurisdictional helps designate that, but it's a group effort. We have a coordinating group and a group of land managers that work together to prioritize where our minimal resources would be, and I can say with most certainty that if it's impacting oil infrastructure, that would be provided a high level of protection.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, moving on to slide five, and the next, just a couple slides, I think it's important to highlight some of the changes that we've seen in the recent last two decades. The top right illustrates the number of acreages that we've seen from 1950 to 1922. The red areas are years of over 3 million acres burned, and that includes 2022. So we are seeing an increase in large fires on the landscape, and that correlates directly with the increasing temperatures in Alaska and the expanding fire seasons. Slide six has three graphics. The one I'd like to point out on the left is just the number of fires we've seen in the last two decades. Alaska has burned just under 32 million acres, which is over 2.5 times more acres than the previous two decades. So we're seeing more fires, larger fires, difficult to suppress fires. The most concerning of these images is the middle, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And you can see from the mid-1950 to the mid-2000s, we had very little fire out in that region. In the last 10 years, we've seen a significant spike, and that's our tundra-based fires. We do have values out there. There's villages out there that we have to protect. We had fires out there this year that really disrupted the lifestyle of those communities, required some evacuations of people with health issues. So that's become something on our radar that is something we have not had to work with in the past or deal with in the past that is a reality right now. And then the graphic on the right just indicates the length of the fire season. That goes from first large fire to last large fire, and you can just see the increase we've had, especially since the 1990s to currently. We're looking at about 45 days more of burning season than we've had historically. And the last of these slides that talks about our challenges is not only the changing fire conditions, but just the population base and where Alaskans live. Just under 75% of our housing units or homes are in the WUI, or the Wildland Urban Interface. That's fire-prone areas. 85% of the new construction is being built in the WUI or fire-prone areas. So on top of the larger fires and more frequent fires, we have our what we are being asked to protect is increasing as well. And some of these are just some of the more recent fires we've had that just are just recent illustrations of those challenges. The Miller's Reach fire in 1996 in the Mattsee Valley burned 350 homes, 450 structures. In the last 7 years, we've had the Sockeye fire and McKinley fire, both in Willow. Both fires lost 55 homes, damaged many others, caused large-scale evacuations. And then you talked about protecting our infrastructure. Representative Hannon in that bottom right is just an example of that. We have not only the pipeline corridor, which is in our protection, we have all the utilities, the power lines, the cell towers, all the infrastructure, the Alaskan investments, including mines, and a lot of those remote operations that we are tasked to protect. And this discussion really today is about the suppression cost, but I did not want to pass up the chance to also talk about a little bit the recovery piece. For each of these communities that has a large fire, there is the cost of suppressing that fire and getting that back to normal, but also the recovery piece. And I'll speak to just the Willow and the Sockeye fire, or the McKinley and the Sockeye fire, both in Willow. The Mattsee Borough estimated that the recovery cost of those fires alone was $200 million apiece. So the suppression is a large concern of ours, but the impact of those communities is the other piece to that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. McDonald, correct?
Correct.
What do we mean by recovery, and what does that exclude? For example, does it exclude the man hours in putting out the fire, and the mitigation effort itself? And how is that paid for? Are those claims through insurance companies? What if you could just drill down into that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the recovery is through multiple different means. Some of it may be through a FEMA recovery. Some of it may be through insurance recovery. Some of it might be people rebuilding on their own if they don't have insurance. Some of it is the damage to infrastructure, power lines, cell towers. That would be on the utility companies. Some of that is on the borough or the community itself. If they have, for example, in the Willow School was shut down for about 3 weeks, so there's costs associated with people having to stay home because their children don't have a place to go to school. So the borough calculates those costs, pulling all of that in there. The suppression costs are completely separate. The cost of putting that fire out and securing it is the, under suppression. The recovery is just what it takes to get people back on their feet, back to, I guess, life as normal.
Follow up?
All up.
So, through the chair, we're used to seeing in this committee and in this building $50 and $100 million costs for the suppression alone, I think. And so in a year like with McKinley Fire, that could be $200 million for recovery and $100 million for suppression?
I'll have to, through the chair, Representative Josephson, I can do research. I think the McKinley Fire was, relatively speaking, suppression-wise, a cheaper fire. Under $10 million. That's still a lot of money. But that was a relatively small fire under 6,000 acres. It was short-term. We had a lot of people on that and got around that relatively quickly. So the damage was much larger than the actual suppression costs. There are other fires that we have that suppression costs are extremely high because they're campaign or long-duration fires. And they're larger. So both of this, the McKinley and the Sockeye fires were, in Alaska, fire terms, relatively small fires under 6,000 acres. The damage was high, but the size of the fire was relatively small.
Thank you.
And this next couple slides, this is where I think just to give you know, give you a look at what the 2022 fire season was like and some of the statistics and where we rank this season compared to some of the other more recent seasons. So we had just over 3 million acres burned, which was the seventh largest acreage since 1950. It was the highest acreage by a state in the nation, which is not uncommon for Alaska. What is unique about this season is it all happened within about 6 weeks. Usually our large fire seasons are over the course of an entire summer. For those of you who live, especially in South Central, you probably remember the rains we started getting in mid-July through August. Up until then, it was one of the unprecedented busiest fire seasons we've had, so compressed into about 6 weeks. Just about half of our fires, which is very common, were human. 270 were human caused, 277 were lightning caused. If you're looking at the map, it does not add up. We have undetermined fires as well that are a part of that. And I think what this just illustrates is in a normal fire season, we'll get our lightning, our dry weather, we'll get lightning and winds, but it's usually in a smaller geographic area. In 2022, we had fires all the way from the far west on the Aleutian, the furthest west that we've ever had, to the Canadian border. Those are, if you look at the distances, and I just like this graphic because it really illustrates the challenges that Alaska brings for a lot of things, but suppressing fires is one of them just with the great distances. And then we talked a little bit about the unusual start. We had a relatively high snowpack, which usually means a later start to our fire season. That melted quickly. And what resulted is April, May, and June were the driest months on record. The top right shows the lack of rain or lack of precipitation during that time frame. And then what followed is on the first week in June was some record days of lightning. So we picked up about 100 new starts in just the course of 2 days. And there was fires spread from Dillingham to the Brooks Range and coast to the Canadian border. So that really started off what our challenge was. We had a lot of fire on the landscape all at the same time, and we prioritized the values and where we were going to put our resources. And this goes back into your question about the fire suppression piece and who's responsible for the costs. The list on the left is the large fires we had. A complex is a group of fires all being managed by a single incident management team. The Lime Complex, for example, was in southwest Alaska. It was 22 million acres of land that had 18 fires. That was being managed under one group. And what's significant about this map is the blue is all state ownership or state jurisdiction. And if you'll see, a majority of the fires are all on state jurisdiction for this year, which resulted in the most expensive fire season that we've had
Can we just take a look back at that previous slide? I think we didn't necessarily have any questions. I think people want to just take a little bit longer look at it.
I think as we move forward, there's some other slides that help explain how unusual this is for the state of Alaska to be to have so much of the burden of the cost just on one agency.
Thank you.
And this is just the again, this is our estimate. What usually takes about another 12 months of auditing and recalculating, but this is what we're estimating our 2022 fire costs to be. And you can see how that is paid out through emergency declarations that we provide to the governor's office and in turn through you. Our average fire season is about $74 million a year. This year we were over doubled that. Some of the drivers for that, what drove those costs, were the importing of Lower 48 resources. If we have more fires than we have resources for in Alaska, we import them from Lower 48. And last year we brought up over 3,000 firefighters to assist, over 100 aircraft. When we ran out of Alaskan vendors, we go to Lower 48 for those aircraft. And then 27 incident management teams, and those are what it takes to manage those large complex fires.
We have a question from Co-Chair Edgman, followed by Representative Cronk.
Isn't the pattern usually that the fires happen earlier in the season in Alaska and then later in the lower 48? So there's a sort of swapping off of resources. But last year in particular, I guess to my question, tundra fires. You know, I live in Dillingham. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. It's getting really scary. We never had that before.
Yeah.
But just to maybe give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about, I don't know if I've seen your slide deck or not, about the interfacing between firefighters in the lower 48 and Alaska firefighters as well.
Yeah, Chair Edmund, yeah, you're correct. First of all, the fires down by Dillingham, we don't get that often. As a matter of fact, that's very rare and has not happened much in recent history. So to have fires in that country is new, and it's a challenge that is definitely, it takes logistics and aircraft, and it really spread us thin this year because we were protecting a lot of values in that country at the same time as we're protecting a lot of the highway corridor. And I don't have I did not put a slide in here on that, and I can provide more information. But Alaska and the lower 48, for most years, have fire seasons that don't overlap very much. So ours starts earlier, which sounds backwards, but our fire season in Alaska starts earlier, usually in April, May, and July, May, June, July. Excuse me. And the lower 48 usually starts picking up in activity like middle of July through into August. So although there is some overlap, they're able to come up and help support Alaska when we need assistance. And in return, as we start backing out of our normal fire season, we send resources south to assist them. 2022 and 19 and 15, we were importers. We brought in a lot more resources than we sent out. In 2020 and 21, we sent out a lot of firefighters to support the lower 48. A lot of that just is seasonal based on whatever the season is like. My concern is when we have those overlapping seasons and we don't get those resources when we need them. And that's a reality because they're facing the same challenges we are with longer seasons where they normally started mid-July or starting in mid-June now. So there's potential for just not having enough resources to go around.
Right. Thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, how many state-based fire crews do we have?
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, we have three Alaska agency crews, so state agency crews, that we are actually challenged right now to fill positions for. We have three contract crews in Alaska through our native corporations. And then we also have what we call our EFF crews. Those are usually village-based rural fire crews. This is something we are trying to rebuild. 10, 12 years ago, we had between 56 and 60 crews based out of rural Alaska that we would call up. This year, we will see after we get through our training, and we have more training available this year than we have in the past, but I think that number is down to about six. So we are well below our normal crew capacity. There's a lot of reasons behind that. We're trying to remedy that through some training and fuels work and some other things that we've made available to us last year. But that's definitely a challenge and something that we are trying to turn around.
Follow up.
So I'm looking at these numbers. I said, is there a number or percent of firefighting dollars that go to outside crews and businesses?
Representative Kronk, or through the chair, Representative Kronk, we do. I don't have those exactly. I do have a slide in here that illustrates the difference between the Alaska fire crew cost and the lower 48. And then there's another slide that shows how many crews we brought up, so we could do some quick math. But I can get those numbers for you if you'd like.
Okay, follow up. Up through the chair. I'm just going to look, kind of make a statement. Looking back, for several years, we had a fire academy in Choke, and in fact, it was so good that Governor Parnell requested that it continue for 10 years. Do you have the ability to look back and explain why that was stopped? And I know we're working on it again, but it seems that there was a vision there and we've fallen back. So I just, hopefully we can have an understanding of why.
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, we did that. That academy was outstanding. I was part of being an instructor for that, and we've modeled the TOPE model in McGrath, and it's an excellent model. It's what we're doing again. Unfortunately, in 2015, we had budget cuts, just like everybody did, and that was one of the things that was cut. So we, with the, actually your support and the governor's support last year, we have that refunded. So we're bringing those academies back. We'll do six of them this year, including some virtual academies. So we are really trying to rebuild our homegrown fire resources, and the academies are a big part of that.
Follow up.
And I know we talked about this before, EFF pay, how is that established and how do we get around that? Obviously, I was an EFF at some point, and I don't really want to guess what I was paid per hour back, you know, in the 90s. But I also know that our village crews are critical to fighting fires in Alaska. So how do we get around if we're following the federal rate? We're able to get those people working again.
Through the chair, Representative Kronk, I don't have the hourly rate for an entry level firefighter. As an EFF, we do model the EFF, which is emergency firefighter. It's our call when needed crews after the federal rates. So every year there's a small increment where those wages go up. To be honest, I don't think it's kept up with some of the other opportunities that people have, which is part of the one of the reasons why we just have a shortage in crews from what we used to. And then back in the 90s, I think it paid relatively well compared to some of the other industry, and we are just not keeping up.
Thank you. I'll have a few more here later on. Right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, a couple of questions. Mr. McDonald, how long can a state firefighter expect to work in a 12-month year and be paid? Is it a six-month gig or longer than that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, for our state, when we have a couple different categories, but what we call our permanent seasonal, so they come back every year, but they're a seasonal employee. For most of those are about 6 months is what they are funded for. When they go to the lower 48 or we have an extended season, that also is extended, so it can be up to 8 months. And then with the fuel emphasis on the fuels work, sometimes that's extended even further out to, you know, 10 months. But what they are funded for right now is 6 months, and that includes time to bring them on to get training and all the refreshers needed to be ready for the fire season.
Follow up, Representative Josephson.
How do these dollars flow exactly? I mean, what we typically see is the funding of these exercises in the late winter, early spring, and i.e. right now, after the fact. So how are you seeing these dollars during the summer? And if not, how are you paying your people?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I do have a slide, a couple down that helps explain that. But these dollars through the declarations are primarily to pay our vendors. So the aircraft, if we use dozers, if we use boats, that type of equipment that we call on time of emergency to support that mission. And it also includes the importing of resources from the lower 48. But I do have a slide that I think might help answer that. There's a difference between our budget components. And I try to explain that because that question has come up before as well.
Okay, and so let's go ahead and take, let's just go a few pages before we come to a natural breaking point, and then we'll ask questions because I know there's a lot of questions that you're having in your slide deck that maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. So
we'll questioning the order I put slides in here now. But slide 15 is just an illustration of the fiscal year, and one of the challenges in which does get confusing is our fire season crosses two fiscal years. Everything in the red was for fiscal year 2022. We had declarations during that time as well. And so that when we talk about the $120 million for fire season 2022, that includes two different fiscal years. FY22 and FY23. So with this, we try to put in there to illustrate the timing of those declarations and what they covered. And For clarification, the last declaration we have, there's $8 million in February. That will help cover some of the unaccounted for expenses in fire season 2022, but also sets us up for the start of fire season 2023. And I think this goes to your question. We have, under the fire program, we have two primary budget components. The suppression preparedness, that's our base wages. That covers our offices, our utilities, basically the cost of doing business, those fixed costs that we have. That's our regular preparedness budget. The suppression or activities component is the component we use to, when we fight fire, those are the funds that go to that suppression. And those are the funds, that's the category we do declarations for. The preparedness piece is fixed. That is covered. It's anything above and beyond our suppression or activities component is when we have to do those declarations. And those are the ones that cover our the crews that come up to Alaska, the aircraft that's not on our regular contracts, the emergency equipment hires we do for dozers, excavators, boats, anything we use to fight those fires. It covers that emergency fire travel for resources around the state. And so that's where those large figures come from. And again, this just, and to Representative Cronk's question, this is just one example of what Alaskan resources versus a lower 48 resource would cost. And for a fire crew, an in-state Alaskan crew is about $6,500 a day. A lower 48 or imported crew is about $13,500 a day. In 2022, that graph on the right just shows how many resources we had to bring to Alaska. So we ordered about 4,200 personnel for Alaskan fires. Of those, over 3,000 came from outside of Alaska, which helps drive those high costs. And I thought this would be useful to help show just on one fire how those costs are accrued, how they're used, and why they're spent. And then, and what that looks like. And I just think this is important because it dives down a little deeper into just the fire business and why some of these costs are what they are. This is a map of the Clear Fire. It was in between Denali National Park and Fairbanks. It started early June with a lightning strike. It was in full protection, so it received a full initial attack. We did not have all the resources available to catch that at a smaller acreage, and it escaped initial attack and became a larger complex fire for us. We were tasked with protecting some of the values in that area, which included the city of Clear. There's four rural subdivisions that we were protecting with about 100 residences back in there. The Clear used to be Air Force Base, now Space Force Base. It's about a $5 billion infrastructure that's along the highway corridor. There's the highway corridor itself, which we've had shut down in past fire seasons, which is critical to keep that open. That's the lifeline between South Central and the interior, and then all the way up to the Hall Road to the North Slope. And then there's a lot of power and infrastructure, communication infrastructure in the vicinity as well. So those are the values we were protecting. We used several incident management teams and hundreds of people rotating through that fire to achieve that. I will point out this is the one fire we had last year where we qualified for federal, it's called FMEG assistance, so FEMA. We work with FEMA to get reimbursed for 75% of the costs, so we are anticipating bringing back $20 million from these suppression costs from this incident. And the graph on the left is how that fire was just under $27 million and how those dollars are spent. A large portion of it is to aircraft. That's our water scooping and retardant dropping aircraft. Includes the flight time to bring them to Alaska when needed. The line equipment includes our boats and dozers and excavators that we build our fire line with. Obviously, the crews speaks for itself. Those are the 20-person fire crews. And just under half of that is the support. For every firefighter out there, there's people that are trying to feed them, provide them medical attention, get them supported with the equipment they need, giving a place to sleep at night, and taking care of those folks out on the line. So that's fairly common of what a fire breakout would look like as far as the percentage of the costs. I included the Middle Tanana Complex on the right. That was a remote fire, something we were just doing point protection of the Pogo Mine and cabins along some of the river corridors. And it's a little higher in logistics support, a little higher on aircraft support, At that time, we had fewer firefighters available, less crews, so we changed our strategy to just protecting a few of the most critical items, the Pogo mine and some cabins. But that's how that fire was broken out. And this is very common just for an Alaska fire, the breakout of the fire costs, whether it's $1 million fire or a $10 million, Madam Chair.
We have a question from Representative Josephson.
Through the chair at page 19. So are these dollars base dollars or declaration dollars?
These, through the chair, Representative Josephson, these would be declaration dollars, so fire suppression dollars. These would come out of, since we're suppressing a fire, it comes out of the suppression component. And if we don't have enough funds in the suppression component, we do a declaration. So for this fire, for example, we started off the fiscal year, so July 1st, with $13.6 million in our suppression account. In about 3 weeks, that had been gone. Our daily burn rate for this fire and others exceeded that amount, and we did our first declaration in July to cover the anticipated costs for this fire, as well as all the other fires we had to save protection last year.
Great. Follow.
This is where I was going previously. How are you? You said the budget, this account, $13.6 million was gone. So how are you getting the remainder if we're not in session? That's what I can't figure out.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we do an emergency declaration. So that goes from our agency through the department to the governor's office, and it's part of that emergency response. I believe it would be similar to if there was another natural disaster and there was a declaration done for that. That's the process we follow for this.
Sounds like a statutory delegation of appropriation power or something. Right. Thank you.
Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, on the slide before, on page 18, you mentioned FEMA reimbursement. Is that what's the percentage of the reimbursement, and about how long does it take you guys to get the reimbursement?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, it's the process to apply for and to know if we're going to be successful just takes a matter of about a week to go through that process. We work closely with our regional representation and work through a particular fire. It's based on the number of values that are threatened within a certain vicinity, so this qualified for that. We originally pay the cost. The state pays all the suppression fees, and then we get reimbursed. It's a bit of a accounting problem after that. Usually it's about 75%. We start getting reimbursed after about a year or two, but it takes up to 5 years to get the full reimbursement from FEMA before it's complete. That varies from fire to fire and year to year. So, but yeah, 3 to 5 years is pretty common.
Can I have a follow-up? Through the chair. So, do you know where the reimbursement funds go when you do get the money? Does it come back to the actual account that was reimbursed, or?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, it goes back to the general fund, is my understanding. And as that comes back in, it just goes back into there. I would have to ask probably somebody from OMB to might have a little more information on that.
Thank you.
All right.
This is the, I guess if there's any slide in this presentation that kind of says what was different with 2022, it's this one. The illustration on the left is our five-year average of the fiscal breakout between state and federal. And on the right is 2022. And again, this is based purely on where the fire started and where that where they needed to have suppression. So this was an extremely rare year in a lot of senses. The fiscal responsibility was the big one.
I have a question on that last pie chart there on the last page. On the right-hand side, is that just because by happenstance it happened to be that way? No real reason that you can pinpoint?
Just where the lightning struck, and then if it was in full protection or critical, or where the values were. Most of the fires we suppressed last year, I will say a big portion were in state protection. There was a lot of fires in federal protection that were on state land. And then we work closely with the Alaska Fire Service to make fiscally responsible decisions. They're they're providing the protection. We have representatives that work with them to make sure the strategy is sound, the tactics are correct, that we all agree on the actions being taken. So it's, and then they do the same for us. When we have fires on federal land, they have representation that works with us to make sure the strategy, the tactics, and how we're spending federal dollars lines up with what they would like.
Co-Chair Edgen?
Yeah, just to add to that, I know in the Dillingham area, in large part of Southwest, last summer we basically sort of had two summers. The first summer, first part of summer was incredibly hot, dry, unprecedented, just sort of day after day of like 80 degree weather. And I'm sure that played a role in terms of, you know, lightning strikes or just any sparks in the tundra that created those tundra fires. And then the second part of the summer was rainy, like excessively rainy. And it's just interesting, the winter before then, in November of 2021, we had the coldest November in 80 years, followed by just a tremendous stormy December, power outages for several days, icing, all that stuff. But things are changing. They really are changing. And I'm hoping at some point to, not right now, I'm a co-chair, but, you know, at some point to take you back to slide number three, and I want to ask you a question or two in that regard.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Edgman, it is changing, and I've seen it just in my career. I've started in 1989 as on a fire crew, like Representative Cronk did, and just in my career, I've seen these changes and fires in places you never thought you would be fighting fire. When you look at fires on ADAC of 900 acres, I would have never thought we would have had something like that. And in that country around Dillingham is another place where we would get lightning fires, we would get fires, but none of them grew like they did last year. Mm-hmm. There is some really interesting research being done by the University of Fairbanks and some of the fire ecologists that shows just how fast things are changing. I would recommend if you get an opportunity to speak to that group, there's some really interesting but unnerving research that they're doing about our kind of what the future is looking like for fires.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. McDonald, I'm thinking back to the summer of 2019 and the Swan Lake Fire Complex, the summer that never stopped burning. And I know it was largely on federal land, but the state did much of the response. And I completely understand the accounting nightmare and multiple years it takes. My question kind of goes to whether there are legal fights that you find between the state and the feds over those, or are they accounting fights? Because one of the rhetoric pieces we use up here a lot is statehood defense and some litigation with the feds. And we, you know, I guess I'm starting to have my head spin around if we prevail on this piece of water being state jurisdiction because it's navigable water, yet the land on either side of that piece of water remains federal, what that means for our response and ability to recover the costs when, of course, on the fire line, you're not worried about whose land it is that day. It's the crew responding, and you know, the state and BLM have worked this out through decades of joint response and let the accountants delineate how many dollars are ours and how many dollars are theirs. But I'm wondering if you're starting to have lawyers weighing in over, we're not going there, that's the feds, let them carry it themselves.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I would say, so I have the opportunity to go all over the country for fires. One of the hats I wear, I'm the incident commander for the Alaska incident management team. We fight fire in Alaska, then go California, wherever the fires are. And I've seen some terrible fights right during a fire about who's responsible for what. I will say in Alaska, we are very lucky. We have a very good fire plan, and we have a good cooperative agreement that we lean on that really takes a lot of the fight out of it. We have not had to use attorneys. We have accountants that go through it, and we have good record keeping, so we don't have those same challenges that our other states do. And I can tell you we are really lucky to have that, because that's not the same everywhere. I think where we do have some things we are working on, and actually the next slide I hit on that, is just in the fire plan itself. It was put together during the 80s and through the 90s, and we need to make sure that stays updated. There's places where we are protecting federal assets that are around, state land is around, that we are working with the BLM and other agencies to make sure we're not being asked to do something that we're not asking them to do. And so we're working through those fire plans to make sure those are updated and modernized as well. But again, the relationship we have with our federal cooperators is very strong. We share resources. We figure our problems out with some phone calls, and that's not the case everywhere, so I feel pretty lucky to work in Alaska and not some other places.
Thank you. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Norm MacDonald. So I have a couple of just kind of, let's call it housekeeping budgetary questions in line with the priorities here of the fire program. So correct me if I'm wrong, we had a supplemental presentation before us regarding fire service. It was an additional $50 million. So I'm checking my amend budget in front of me. I see that we need an additional $6.8 million on top of that. I believe that basically means we've already spent the $50 million we requested, we need more. But it also says that this supplemental is supposed to cover our fire priority needs until June 23. So given the fact that it is February and there's a lot of bad fires on state land that have happened in this, I guess call it fire season year, you know, do we think that additional $6.8 million is going to be anywhere near adequate to cover what probably will be a higher expense than that? That's my question.
That's a good question. So through the chair, Representative Stapp, that is something that we base that on an average year. And if it's an average year or below average, that number that fits the budget. We should spend that or less. But if we have a fire season like 2022 or 19 or 15, that won't be enough, and we'll have to ask for a declaration to cover those expenses. So we, you know, I was just talking to our fire admin staff this morning. For an average season, that will cover our expenses. And I wish I could predict what 2023 would be like. And we're getting better at it, but usually not until about March or April. We have a starting to get an understanding what kind of fire season we might be in store for.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Director MacDonald. So just out of curious, how long, so in one of these situations that we've had, especially last year with the fires on state land priority, like how far does like $6 million go in fire suppression? How does that translate? Is that like three fire days, depending on the fire? Like what does that actually look like?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, it's... I don't have our daily burn rate last year, but when we are in peak season, like a summer like last year, where we have six or eight teams out managing these large fires, that's probably about 3 days worth of suppression.
Thanks.
On an average year, we don't have to worry about that.
All right. We have a question from Representative Kronk, followed by Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, I might hog up some time here. Our main word today is suppression. An ounce of prevention is a pound of cure. And I think we can go back and realize that all we've talked about is fighting fires. We're not talking about preventing fires. And this is where our forestry division, I'm going to expect a lot out of our forestry division. We have the great Mayor Fairbanks here, and we want to make sure that all of our communities are somewhat protected by prevention, and whether that means mechanical removal of hazardous materials, whether that means opening up sales for firewood for you know, timber harvest, very strategically around all of our communities. And so one thing I've never heard, and when I first moved to Northwind, you're talking to the native elders, is even back before white people were here, they would do controlled burns. And it seems like that is a non-existent term anymore, because not only did it help protect from fires, it created habitat for whether it's moose, rabbits, it didn't matter. And I think I would rather spend $30 million on fire prevention than $120 million on suppression. So I really hope that over the next course of the next few years that we can really turn the table here and let's be preventative versus I know we have to be ready, and I don't think anybody's going to argue that, but I want to make sure that we have plans in place for every community in Alaska. I think the road system's a little easier. A question would be, what's the expense of removing an acre of hazardous material mechanically versus by hand? I think when we start having to look at this kind of stuff, and maybe you probably know the answer to that, and I would like to hear that because especially our communities on the road system, that is something that, you know, if we have millions of dollars to be preventive, why are we not using that avenue to help?
Through the chair, Representative Kronk. Well, I'll try to answer. There's a couple parts of that. So the first one is the prevention, and I look at it as preventing human-caused fires, human-caused starts. And you're right, that is that the human-caused fires in our communities are the most expensive fires. So if we can reduce those, and we do that through education and enforcement, changing some of our regulations, that's how we reduce those fires, and that's an important part of the fire program and something that we are investing in as much as we can right now to do. The other part of the prevention is the fuels component. We have been doing fuels reduction projects going back to the late 90s, but not at a very fast pace. It was all federally funded. It was through a process, a program called the WUI grants, Wildland Urban Interface grants. Those were very small projects. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the division received $17 million in CIP for fuels reduction. And about 2 years after that, we had the infrastructure funding, which we're just starting to see come into the state for fuels work. So we have fuels projects in every one of our communities right now that are either happening or in the planning process that will happen in the near future. So that's a big part of our program. That doesn't reduce the fire starts, but what it does is you talk about the recovery piece and protecting your communities. That's what that will do. To answer your question, the cost from mechanized by hand, we have some examples. I can send you like a briefing paper on what that costs. We have a project right now happening in the Matsu Valley. It's called the Sunset. It's a 7-mile fuels break that started in November, and they're going to have it done, you know, by the time fire season starts, and it is all mechanized with just a little hand cleanup. There are other places where it's more sensitive, around schools or infrastructure or homes, and they don't necessarily want to have an excavator going through and, you know, pushing down all their trees, so we do those by hand. So there's a place for both. Your right hand treatments are much more expensive per acre, but there's a place for both of them, and we look at the best tool for the job to make that decision. We will see over the next several, we've got a lot of projects going right now that are, we're just starting to come to fruition and come to completion that we can share with you. And over the next 5 years, we've got a good 5-year plan to continue that. Pretty much all of our roadside communities and our rural communities, villages, where they have a high threat of fire as well. We've got work started in there.
Very good. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. McDonald, I just wanted to check in on the recruitment and retention piece. We're hearing this with every agency doing everything possible and actually a lot of thought into how much the work that they're trying to do is on fire because they can't have enough of the employees that they'd like to have. And I just wondered, in your case, if you have sensed that if your crews are large enough for your initial response, and if there's any sense that you'd sure like to get on these fires on the front end to snuff them out a little faster, if there's been any of that concern. I know sometimes there's some competing efforts with the lower 48 and getting someone here fast enough and such. I just wondered if you had any comments to that.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Galvin, the recruitment retention is our number one challenge right now. It is really difficult, and I think in fire management itself is a is a huge challenge. We need people with the experience that have been around for a while, understand Alaska, the conditions and the fuels, to make sound decisions. And that's been a challenge, keeping that level. And then more recently is just the crews. Representative Kronk brought up our EFF and village crews, our agency crews as well. We are, this year, we have three agency crews, and we are going to really struggle to get one full crew and then two, maybe partly a half crews. So it's I have it on my list here as our number one challenge and thing. We're looking at how we can address that.
Follow up?
So am I understanding you to say that with recruitment and retention being such a challenge for you that you may have a more difficult time in reaching your mission, your end goal, if you don't have enough there? And so you do see this to be a real problem. Yes?
It is a problem. The way we will work around that is we will bring in fire crews to Alaska, and I realize that is more expensive, and we want to keep jobs local, but we have to be prepared to protect our communities. That's how we will address that.
Thank you very much.
I had a kind of a random question. Are you finished with the slide? Did you have anything you
wanted
to add?
That was the last slide. I did it. Yeah, I won't.
Okay. I know there was discussion. I have not heard it this year, but discussion about the Alaska Long Trail and how that would be a potential fire break. Have you guys, the division talked about that at all, or is that just something that someone's came up with and thought it was a good way to sell the project?
Madam Chair, I have not heard of the Long Trail, not how it would help with fire suppression.
Okay. Just checking, and then, as far as maybe access, so good to know. And then I wanted to make sure that we don't forget that Representative Edgman wanted to go back and maybe talk about page 3, but first of all, right? So, okay, Representative Staff and then Co-Chair Redman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair to Director McDonald, I too have a random question. I'm not sure if you can answer it, but it dawned on me that we are, a lot of discussion is on carbon offsets and carbon sequestration. Offsets, obviously, I like to refer to tree money sometime because that's what we're basically selling. But I guess what happens if the fires burn down our trees that are in our carbon offset? Are we on like the hook for a refund? If anyone considered that, just curiosity.
Through the chair, Representative Snap, I think we are just starting to look at that and what that would entail. Director Ng has actually a carbon hearing today that they may go into that, but he may be able to speak to that a little better than I can.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that is always a risk in any project, and you're right. Some willing buyer has paid you millions of dollars to keep those trees on the site, and if they burn down, then what do you do? There is a insurance pool built into most of the registries, where in the case of the American Carbon Registry, for one, every project developer pays 18% of their proceeds into that insurance fund. So it's basically an insurance pool, so that if one project suffers a reversal, to use the term, which is a fire, then that is covered through that insurance pool. Going forward from that point, if the entire forest burns down, you don't get a further payment, but at least you don't have to pay back what you already received.
No refunds. I like it.
All right. Co-Chair Edgman.
Yeah, I guess just to go back to slide 3.
Apologize if you're getting dizzy. There might be another driver here that would have helped.
So when you look at the graphic, obviously the predominant color is dark green, which means that it's a lowest priority for fire sort of resource assignments. But I know in Southwest Alaska, at least a few years ago, on a few slides somewhere in the middle of the deck, you talked about the uptick or the surge for the last 10 years in the YK area, which I think would also mean, my part of my district in the lower Southwest. But you know, if you were to, I'm not asking you to hazard a guess, I guess, but 5-10 years down the way, this map could look different, right? I mean, there's a lot of areas that are mountainous. There's water bodies. There's areas that aren't methane-inducing and this, that, and the other. But the brown and the yellow areas, perhaps even the red, are going to increase if the current warming trends continue. I'm not trying to drag you into a climate change questioning like that, but it's just the reality. The trends are continuing one way. But what we're seeing today, you know, if fire suppression costs are $60, $70 million in the supplemental budget this year, down the road it could be quite more significant, right? I mean, that's just the way the arrow is pointing at this point in time.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Edmund. The critical is areas where there's like high values at risk. So that would really drive it. If we were getting more mines or more communities, that would be the driver for the critical. I think what will change, and this is something just for the state and for the federal, is just some of the strategies we take on fires. If we can't catch a fire at initial attack, and I will use last year as an example, we had fires where we had all of our best resources, smoke jumpers, like a hotshot crew or retardant aircraft, helicopters, all trying to keep a fire under 10 acres, and they weren't successful. That is just an indicator that some of the strategies that we've used in the past might not work. So I think what the future looks like for us is how do we protect those values ahead of time? And that's where the fuels comes in, is to protect those villages, those communities, that infrastructure with fuels projects and fuels breaks, knowing if we get a fire, we might not be able to catch it, but we'll have a place to work from to protect those values. So I think that's what will change. And as I think where the more red on the map, as you put it, for the critical will come in as our communities expand along the road system. There's a lot of that road system that's in full that we evaluate annually and make those decisions, whether that's critical or what that should be changed to. But the initial response is based on like life, human life, and homes. I will say for any of the protection levels that we're in, we have a process called a non-standard response. So if it's something, if there's a fire in limited, but we feel like it will threaten some critical infrastructure, whether it be a mine or a community, we will take action on that regardless of the pre-designated option.
Well,
you know, in Village Alaska, this just really underscores how we don't have enough fire equipment in the villages. I can think of one of my villages, New Stuyahok, where we have a fairly new fire department building, but we don't have a fire truck. And if there's a fire similar to the 2022 season that's close by to one of those villages, I'm sure the response time will be swift, but to not have the ability in the community itself to sort of contribute, I think it's an area that we in the legislature really need to focus on. The second thought is to the fire academies and the importance of growing our own. And, you know, I'm sure it's a pretty lucrative job being a firefighter. I've never been one, but it's got to be about one of the toughest jobs around, you know, 80 degree temperatures or whatever might be fighting fires, you know, with the good old fashioned manual labor. But it just, I guess the takeaway from this hearing for me today is that this is, you know, this is a huge issue. I have to confess that, you know, as a lifelong Alaskan, I've been watching the increase, and, you know, I've been on this committee for almost a decade. The number just sort of, you know, getting bigger and bigger at times. You know, I knew people who lost homes in the Miller's Reach fire back in 1996, almost 20 years ago. But I really appreciate the presentation and how it underscores that this issue is a big issue, and it's something we need to focus as much possible time and resources on. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we do have three more questions. Representative Josephson, or I'm sorry, I'll start this with Representative Hannon. I think you were first in line, Representative Josephson, and then Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you.
We'll take your questions in that order.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. McDonald, Chair Johnson's question about the Alaska Long Trail provoked my thinking, and I understand it's going to vary, but and I'm thinking again to the Swan Lake fire that jumped the Sterling Highway and the fires that have been able to jump the Parks Highway. But if you're putting in a fire break, what are the standard widths or dimensions that you would be thinking should be built for a standard fire? And I understand that the fuel's building up the speed and the temperature and the winds all play into that. But figuring out that long trail where a break would have to do with with the width and the fuels surrounding it.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it really does vary depending on the fuel types and terrain, if there's slope or not. But I think the important piece to understand are those fuel breaks aren't a place where we just let a fire burn up to and it stops. That gives the firefighters a place to have a tactical advantage to work from. So usually we are burning out from that pre-existing line to remove the fuels between the fire and that value, whatever we're protecting. We don't build those thinking that it's going to burn up to that point and stop. So there's places where, you know, maybe a 100-foot line is sufficient, and there's places where we're doing 300-feet line, and on a bad day, a fire in Alaska will cross the Yukon River. So we don't count on them to stop the fire. It's a place to give our firefighters a safe place to work from to protect whatever value it's built around.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, just because I want to be really clear, on the question of prevention versus suppression and costs associated, which is the least expensive?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if you can prevent a fire from starting, that's that is the way to save suppression dollars. Okay. And those are the human-caused fires that we can... I mean, just go back to that, the Clear Fire, which is almost $27 million. That fire, that was a lightning fire, to be clear. But if that's a human fire that we could prevent through education or enforcement or whatever it might be, that's how we save suppression dollars.
Oh, let me, may I follow up?
Follow up.
To clarify, what I mean is, I don't mean education and the like. I mean, these mitigation measures that are taken prior to, so these human capital intensive measures, like fire breaks before fire season.
Okay, I understand. Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson, the fire breaks when they're used can reduce the suppression cost. It'll keep a fire smaller. But really what those do is, that's the recovery piece. If we can protect a community from having to go through a devastating wildland fire, there's the suppression component that's reduced, but probably just as importantly is just that recovery. The infrastructure and the homes remain standing. That's where the value of that fuel break is. It does help reduce fire costs to have that pre-existing work there, because you're going to have to do it time of, and we might have all the resources to do it time of. So to have that work completed ahead of time is much cheaper, because you can do that through different means than an emergency declaration to start the work, you know, days before a fire reaches that community.
Okay. And finally.
Final follow-up.
We started out talking about personnel and loss of personnel. I'm sure we touched on that. I think our law does not treat wildland firefighters the same as urban firefighters. Should that be changed in your view? And is that a source of upset for firefighters, wildland firefighters?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not 100% sure how to answer that. I think nationally we are seeing that wildland fire is an issue that we have to address, and that includes having the right people with the right skill sets and experience and training to do that job. I think we're moving in that direction, but it's something we definitely need to continue to improve on.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, I'm kind of touching on a lot of different topics here that have been expressed throughout this meeting. You know, I'm hoping that one of the missions of the Division of Forestry is to actually put the Division of Fire Protection out of business, meaning that I would like to see an aggressive stance on actually getting those resources out to private individuals, private businesses, and allow them to get into, especially in congested areas around cities and other areas that are better and easier accessible, you know, to get those resources out to private industry. We had an issue with a state park within Fairbanks just this year, and the Forest Service came in and downed a lot of trees, cleaned up that park, and piled up that wood, and then they opened it up to the public. And I was one of those that showed up with my truck and loaded a lot of firewood. It happened so fast. You didn't even have to advertise. People came and they took care of those resources and they cleaned it up and got all that firewood out of there. I'm hoping that we can see this in more an organized fashion to where we can get those resources out to private industry and households, individuals. On that, and I don't have a question on that. I'm just, you know, a statement. And on slide 17, we have a fire assignment. 22-person Alaska crew costs $6,500 a day. When I fought fires, I used to be one of those emergency firefighters almost 30 years ago. We had a 16-man crew, and we had a crew boss, three squad bosses, and the rest were firefighter EFFers that we called them. And when I look at this statistic of 75% coming from out of state last year, I go back to Representative Kronk's question on the TOC project for getting more firefighters out there. You probably touched on it, but I'd like a little more clarification to see if we are actually out there aggressively recruiting more emergency firefighters. It was a great job for me. In between going to college and in the summertime, I'm fighting fires. And I just wondered if you're getting back into that groove of recruiting more firefighters so we don't have to. Yeah, my last fire, I went down to the States. They took our crew down to Washington to fight a fire in Washington. That was my very last fire I was on. And we did 7/12s. Which I was really upset with, because when I'm in Alaska, I'm doing 7/16s. That means I'm 7 days a week, 16 hours a day. So basically noon on Tuesday, it's overtime, right, for the rest of the week. So I was a little upset. Are you still doing 7/16s with these 22-person crews? And is it the same for the crews coming from the lower 48?
Through the chair, Representative Tom Sawski. So we do that. We have some rules for our firefighter safety that we follow. One of them is it's called the 2-to-1 work rest ratio. So in most circumstances, we will not work somebody past 16 hours. And we also work, after a 2-week assignment or work period, they're required to have 2 days off. So that, I think that has changed since the 90s. And that's when I started as well. That has not changed a whole lot, although we have some just safety standards we've set to make sure people are rested before we put them back out in the line again. That was abused for a lot of years, and we've had some injuries that were avoidable because of it. I think what you're saying is, are we doing everything we can to recruit from within the state? And I can tell you we are. We are out with working with the village corporations, the native corporations, every community, the universities. We have people in high schools. We are putting advertisements up in movie theaters. Social media is hitting it this time of year. It is out there. We are doing everything we can to recruit within Alaska. We are making the training available to as many people as possible. And for myself personally, it is this job builds character. He said it is hard work. But I think every kid should go do something like this for a couple of years. And so we are doing everything we can to build the capacity in Alaska in our crews, from rural Alaska to our largest towns. We are recruiting, and we will continue to do that. I think when you were talking about using some private sector and making resources available, we try to do that when we have fuels project to make that available for firewood and help communities out in the villages where we do work. That usually goes to elders. So we have programs that we try to follow to make sure we're making the best use of those resources. So I think we're on the same page with that. But I do want to, I guess the point I want to make is we are taking whatever steps we can to try to recruit Alaskans, put Alaskans to work in Alaska. We need those crews here. And we're trying to make sure that happens.
All right. Thank you. And we're going to have our final question from Representative Cronk.
Thank you, Coach Johnson. Through the chair, a quick statement. You know, if we look at, I'm going to pick the choke area. Okay, we have a harvestable timber abundance. We have a business that's value added. And there's other, you know, other areas have value added. We need long-term sales. Harvesting mature timber reduces fire risk. Putting in access roads to harvestable timber opens other accesses for firewood, subsistence, recreational activities, improves habitat for various other animals, and also carbon sequestration. You got the new trees growing, it's better. So the precedence is set for really, really, really good forestry practices here. Correct. I have a question though. So as we do our EFFs, are we following BLM guidelines, federal guidelines? And my question is we have a lot of people in our villages that can't fight fires anymore because maybe they did something that has hurt them criminally, right? And so here they are. They can't get on base for, you know. So do we have, let's say, and that's Fort Wainwright, I guess, just to be on the record. Do we have an area in Fairbanks, you know, International or the airport there where we could base crews out? What I see is there's people that have made mistakes, but they want to work. And this is in their DNA, to be honest with you, especially in our area. You know, firefighting was something to be very, very proud of. It was a sense of pride. And I'm just wondering how we can maybe as a state work our regulations so we're not excluding those people from our much-needed workforce, especially when we're fighting fires.
Through the chair, Representative Cronk, we do have restrictions on who we can hire, and it's just through you know, some of it depends on the criminal history or background. There are processes where an individual can work with a judge to get work through that, and we can hire them. We've assisted people with that before, realizing people make mistakes in their younger years, and so we have worked with individuals that have had that to try to get them available to be on our fire crews, especially those rural fire crews. And it's something that we could probably look into and do some research on if there's more we can do for that. I think it's less of a Division of Forestry and Fire Protection issue, more of just some of the state hiring practices that we have to work with.
Quick follow-up. Oh, so for, let's say our fire checks, you know, so we got a Elevates and Delta. I know we're struggling to get those people hired there because, and I don't even want to presume I know their wage, but I know their wage isn't very good. And sometimes when you ask them, I had a conversation with a few of them that work, and it's literally a bump of a few bucks an hour, and it makes all the difference in the world. So I will entertain the idea of working with you so we can figure out, so we can get those manned. I mean, I don't want to see the Delta, you know, Helitech not have the six or seven people they need there. So however we can work together to hopefully address that. We want those positions filled. Because those are our initial attack, like you said.
Yeah, they are. Well, and through the chair, Representative Cronk, no, appreciate that, and it's we'll take you up on it when the time is right to make that happen.
And through the chair, Representative Cronk, on the first part of your question, long-term timber sales, access roads, harvesting merchantable timber, fuel reduction, we agree 100%, and we appreciate your leadership on that, and we look forward to working with you on that, and it reflects the governor's priorities, and we look forward to continue working with you on that.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. What a great and interesting conversation we've had today. Thank you. It's always good to have Division of Forestry here before us. The next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, February 21 at 1:30 p.m. In our next meeting, we will receive a budget overview from the Department of Public Safety. Presenting the overview will be James Cockrell, the commissioner. And with no further business before the committee, at 2:58, we are adjourned.